So I have this lousy cold, which has prevented me from attending a number of talks that I would have otherwise been very interested to hear. So you may notice that there is not a lot of physics in any of my three titles. So I want to actually tell you about a problem in economics, but it's a problem in which some of the principles of diffeomorphism invariance that you may be familiar with from general relativity reappear. And it's also the last talk of the day, so I'm going to try to make it, colloquial style. We'll see. So the problem that I want to talk about is one of the mainstream problems in the middle of microeconomic theory, and it's the problem of a monopolist faced with a population of anonymous agents that he wants to market some sort of product to. So you can imagine the monopolist isn't going to manufacture cars, and what is a car? Well, a car can be parameterized by, say, its fuel efficiency, its safety, its comfort, its appearance, its performance. So right now a car is a point in a five-dimensional space. If we think of a few other parameters that cars may have, it becomes a point in a seven-dimensional space. And what the monopolist knows is a cost to him to manufacture a car with particular parameters. And he's also done some market research. So he knows the value of a car of type Y to a potential customer of type X. And similarly, we're going to take potential customers to be parameterized by several variables, like how much they care about safety and how much they care about fuel efficiency, whether or not they're single or have a family. That may affect things. So a potential customer is also going to be a point in a high-dimensional space. And so we have these two. Here's the set of potential customers, and here's the set of potential vehicles which the monopolist can manufacture. And for simplicity, I'm going to take the dimensions of the two spaces both to be the same, finite and the same. And so the monopolist knows the cost over here to manufacture. And he knows the value of car of type Y to customer of type X. And he also knows, he knows what's the relative frequency of customers of type X as compared to X prime in the population. So he has a probability measure over here on the space of potential customers. Let's call it mu. And we'll take it to integrate to 1. And what he wants to decide are which types of cars should he manufacture and how much should he charge for each of them in order to maximize his profits. And it's a little bit of a depressing theory because it's the theory that's supposed to explain things like why does it cost more to buy an airline ticket that doesn't include a Saturday night stay? And why do airlines need to make economy class seating sufficiently uncomfortable that people who can have the means to buy up to business class are willing to pay a lot more for a business class ticket and so on? On the other hand, there's a more kind of utopian version of this theory in which instead of maximizing the monopolist's profit, we try to make the general wealth, we try to spread as much welfare around as we can subject to the constraints of the monopolist not lose money. So this is the kind of theory that governs the operation of things like the Toronto Transit Corporation. So we want to provide transit to make as many people as happy as possible in terms of their transit opportunities without losing too much money. And it turns out that the mathematics that I'm going to describe for the monopolist problem also pertains to this this problem of maximizing social welfare. And I should also say, I mentioned that this is in the center of microeconomic theory, so it turns out the same mathematics describes many different economic problems, and this kind of monopolist nonlinear pricing is just one of them. So I put a bunch of references on slide 2. And what these problems all have in common is that they involve private information. So in other words, when an agent comes into my car dealership, I don't know whether they're a rich guy or a poor guy. I don't know whether they care about safety or fuel efficiency. They may want to conceal their true characteristics from me. And so I need to try to design a price menu that, in some sense, philosophically, it forces the agents to reveal their true identity to me. But actually, I don't really care about that. What I care about is that I maximize profits. And actually, two of the famous applications of this theory were developed in the 1970s by Spence and Merlise. So Merlise was actually interested in designing optimal tax structures for a country. And the idea was that you want to design a tax structure that it shouldn't be too heavy, because if you tax people too much, they won't want to work, as in France. or or if you, or they may not want to report their income, as happens in some other countries. And on the other hand, you want to tax them enough that your society doesn't go bankrupt, as in the U.S. It turns out that more or less the same mathematics is pertinent to that problem. And Spence, who was interested in what he called labor market signaling, which is a problem of deciding, so you're a company, and you want to hire employees, and you'd like them to be talented. And so you're going to look at how much education they've acquired, and you're going to take this signal as a proxy for their talent. And so the idea here is that an advanced degree is of no intrinsic value, or the training that they went through to obtain it, except that it indicates how easy it was for them to go through the program. And so then you want to design a sort of remuneration schedule that says, well, we'll pay you X if you have a high school degree, and we'll pay you X plus something if you have a university degree, and we'll pay you X plus something, plus or minus something else if you have an advanced degree. Actually, they worked out this problem in the case where both M and N were one-dimensional. So you had one variable that was basically maybe quality of the vehicles and one variable that was maybe wealth of the customers. And what Spence and Ruiz understood was that if you make some structural assumption on B, namely that the mixed sectional second partials of B have a definite sign, then in that case, the correspondence between the wealth of customers and the quality of the product they choose will be monotone, non-decreasing. And then you can reduce the optimization problem to an ordinary differential equation. And very little was known about what happens in higher dimensions for the next 20 years, except for a special case worked out by Roche and Chonet, which I will describe presently. So here are some more variables, more references. And so you might, if you're a mathematician, you might expect that if the one-dimensional problem is an ordinary differential equation, then the higher dimensional problem should be a partial differential equation, and this expectation proves to be only partially correct. So in places, the solution will, yeah, is there a question? Right, so I will write down an explicit, but basically the profit is, so you're free to design whatever price menu you choose. And then the customers will look at what you're charging for vehicles, and they'll choose the vehicle that maximizes their happiness minus what they have to pay for it. And then you look at what vehicles are chosen, and your profit is the difference between the price you received and what it cost you to manufacture the vehicle. And so you average this over the population. And so one more issue is that, of course, the more you charge for your vehicles, the more your profits are. And so there has to be something that prevents you from raising prices too high. And since there's no competition in this model, the only thing that can prevent you from raising prices too high is that customers have the option to not buy a vehicle from you. And so there's a distinguished point over here, which is called the null product, or the outside option. And you're not allowed to profit from customers who choose that. Yep. So far I've said this. All of these kind of economics models go under it's called the principal agent framework. So the point is there's one monopolist and there's a group of agents on the other side of the market. So as principal, what you're free to choose is a price function. And you're only V. And your only constraint is that you're not allowed to charge for the null product. And then what the agents do in response to this price function is they compute the maximum written there. And then they choose to buy whatever Y attains this maximum. And the quantity I computed here obviously depends on B and V. And so sometimes I'll call it the B transform of V. And this U would be kind of the indirect utility or the amount of happiness that a customer derives faced with a particular price menu V. And so here's a formula, which is basically what I just said in response to the question. my total profits are going to be, well, actually, I prefer to write my total losses because I like minimizing better than maximizing. So my total losses are going to be what it costs me to manufacture those vehicles that are chosen by Agent X minus the price that I get from Agent X for selling them that vehicle. And I integrate that against the probability measure on agents. And the constraint is that V of Y is forced to be normalized to agree to the with my cost to produce the outside option, so I get no profits from those agents who choose the outside option. And I can take them both to be zero if I want. and yes, so sometimes this maximum will not be uniquely attained, and then there's some ambiguity in which product is actually chosen. I guess I called it YVV of X. That's the argmax. And it turns out that if the distribution of agents is absolutely continuous with respect to coordinates on the space X, or at least if it doesn't concentrate on lower dimensional subsets of X, then the points of X, the agents X, who will be indifferent between two or more products is a set of measure zero. However, sometimes I want to deal with finite numbers of agents, and then I have to worry about singular measures on the space capital X. And so in those cases, I need to invoke a tie-breaking rule which says which product is chosen. And the tie-breaking rule that I want to invoke is the one that says the monopolist has the power to influence the agent. If the agent's undecided between two or more products which maximize his utility, the monopolist can convince the agent to choose whichever product is best for the monopolist's profits. So here's the tie-breaking rule. It goes back to Mills, but again, it's only relevant if a positive fraction of the agents concentrates on a lower dimensional subset of capital X. Yes, Katrin.
Is there any way in which this imposed maybe that the cost of manufacturing of the car would depend on the number of agents that actually choose it?
I think that those kinds of effects are important, but I think that this model doesn't see them.
It would happen if CY were to decline was positive.
Yes.
Then for large Y. Oh, okay. This is one way.
Right. Yeah, so everything in this model is linear in quantity consumed, which is unfortunate that it's a mathematical convenience. Oh, yes. Did I say that Spence and Merlees won the Nobel Prizes in 1996 and 2001 for working out the one-dimensional case? Okay. right. So far there's no geometry in this problem, or very little geometry. So let me point out that in addition to wanting to know the price menu, which minimizes his net losses, the other thing that the principal wants to understand from a practical point of view is he wants to know which vehicles to manufacture. And so effectively, this mapping from agent to a type of vehicle they buy, which of course depends on the prices, sets up a mapping from the space X into the space Y. And so for each V, there will be some induced measure which indicates which vehicles are actually consumed. And it'll be the image of the initial measure mu under this mapping YBV. And so every set W over here gets the mu weight of its pre-image under that map. And that target measure is kind of the equilibrium distribution, or the optimal distribution of products that the principal ought to produce. Okay, so I mentioned that there was one example of this theory that was worked out in detail in higher dimensions, and it's the following example. It's the case where you take the preference function V to be bilinear in X and Y, and so the idea would be that the ith coordinate X measures exactly how much customer X cares about parameter I of the vehicle, and that there's no interference between the different parameters. And so Spence and Merlees considered this particular valuation function, and they thought about X being the unit square and having a uniform distribution of customer types in the unit square. and the case where the cost in manufacturing vehicle Y was quadratic. And using a combination of numerical and theoretical evidence, so Y is going to be the positive quadrant, and the null product is going to be at the origin here. And using a combination of numerical and theoretical evidence, what they discovered is that when you solve this optimization problem, first of all, when you maximize your profits, what that means is that a positive fraction of agents at the bottom of the market are going to be priced out of the market. They won't be able to afford a vehicle. And so all the people down here are going to buy the null product. So U will be zero here. And then in the top part of the market, those people who care the most about these two vehicle parameters, Y1 and Y2, the optimal mapping here will be 1-to-1. And so every agent up here will get a customized vehicle. So there'll be sort of a cloud of vehicles up here. And there's a kind of diffeomorphic map. And in between, every customer on this line here will be forced to choose a particular vehicle there. And every customer on the next line over will be forced to choose this particular vehicle here, and so on. So there's some region, every customer on this line chooses that vehicle. So there's some region where it's efficient for the monopolist to force the agents to compromise between the two parameters that they care about. And so this target measure over here has a part that's absolutely continuous with respect to area. It has a part that's absolutely continuous with respect to one-dimensional Hausdorff measure on the diagonal. And it has a Dirac mass sitting at the origin. Now, the Dirac mass had already been observed by Armstrong in 1996, and he said that was actually a hallmark of higher dimensions. So that wasn't generic and wasn't always the case in one dimension, but he observed in two and higher dimensional models that it would always be efficient or optimal to price a positive fraction of agents out of the market. But this one-dimensional stuff here was new, was a new observation of Roche and Chenet, and they called that bunching. And so a natural question was, is this kind of phenomena an artifact of these particular choices that Roche and Chenet made, or is it robust with respect to changing the valuation function or changing the cost to manufacture? And I should say a little bit about how Roche and Chenet did this. So a nice observation is that in case B of XY is bilinear, then this maximum over here is a map for each Y. This is a linear or affine function of X, and when I take a maximum of a bunch of linear functions, what I get is a convex function. And the that convex function is basically the Legendre transform of the price, and this mapping here, the guy that maximizes it will be the derivative. This will equal the derivative of U in Roche and Chenet's case. And so I get this kind of derivative mapping. And what's going on with the convex function U is that it's strictly convex and satisfies a PDE in here. It's zero over here. And in this bunching region, it's flat along these segments, and it's strictly convex in the orthogonal direction. So the fact that the constraint imposed on U that it be convex because it has to rise to the maximum of functions which are affine gets saturated in here, and I don't get a PDE anymore. I get something else. Right, so I want to talk about the robustness of this kind of phenomenon and what one could do for other valuation functions. I should say for this particular one, Carlier and Lachon-Robert were able to show that the resulting U that minimizes the principal's losses is actually C1 up to the boundary, and so this mapping here turns out to be a continuous map. For other valuation functions, much less is known. But Carlier in his PhD thesis was able to show that there's still enough compactness and continuity in the problem that under rather general hypotheses, there is a profit-maximizing or loss-minimizing solution. Very little can be said about characterizing it in this kind of generality. But so in Mercier and Chenet's problem, the compactness came from the fact that the whole problem of minimizing losses can be reformulated as a problem of minimizing over convex functions U. And what Carlier did was sort of a generalization of that. And the idea is, let B be a general function now. To be able to be written as a max of this form still places constraints on U. So in fact, if I call this the B transform of V, and I define a similar operation, which might be like the D tilde transform of U, a similar operation with X and Y interchanged, if I iterate these operations, then I get something which is some kind of generalization of the idea of the convex hull of the graph of V. And as with convex functions, if you do this operation twice, you get back the original function. The same thing is true here. If I do this operation three times, I get the same thing as if I had done it once. And it turns out the set of functions which are fixed under doing this operation twice is actually has enough compactness to get existence of a minimizer out. So the questions I want to talk about today are basically, what can we say about this minimizer? Is it unique? Can we characterize it in some way? And can we compute it? And so in some sense, for me, all of these kind of questions boil down to the question of whether or not the minimization problem that I'm trying to analyze is a convex problem or not. So convexity helps both computationally and theoretically for the following reasons. I drew a caricature here. You know, if I follow the gradient of a convex function downward, so then I eventually get to the bottom, which was the smiley face on my graph. If I have a non-convex function, I follow its gradient downward in a numerical scheme, I can get stuck at a point like this. If I have a convex function, its derivative vanishes, I know I'm at the bottom. If I have a non-convex function, its derivative vanishes, I don't know where I am. Here I can have a local minimum, which isn't global. Here I can't have that. Okay. So the theme of the talk is going to be what kind of conditions on the data, B and C, and U, guarantee convexity of the optimization problem I'm trying to solve. So I first need to talk a little bit about what does the set of what does the mapping YV of X look like, which achieves this minimum. And so for that, it's useful to notice that I always have U plus V minus B larger than 0. And I'm interested in the set of Y and X pairs for which equality holds. And so, of course, if things are smooth enough, when this non-negative function is 0, its first and second derivative, of course, this is for all X and Y. Its first derivative has to vanish, and its second derivative has to have a sign. And so equality here implies, in particular, a relation like this. And the first thing I want to assume is that I can invert this relation to solve for Y as a function of X. Right, so I guess 1-to-1 with smooth inverse. So this is going to turn out to be a condition which I'll call B1 later. And I want the inverse to be a smooth function of X in this cotangent vector here. And I guess I'll call that y sub b. And usually in the end, I'm going to need to make the same kind of hypothesis for the function, which I get by interchanging the x and y variables. So I want this to hold not only for b, but also for b tilde. And of course, there's an implicit function theorem on this mapping for the inverse to be smooth, namely that the y derivative of this thing should be non-degenerate, and that exactly generalizes Spencer-Mealy's condition from one dimension. And so when I can do that, when I have this hypothesis, then I know that actually ybv of x will be yb of x and this cotangent vector. And now I can go back to the principle of losses, which we said were so we said they were something like the cost of manufacturing the vehicle chosen minus the revenue we received for selling it. Integrated against the measure in question. And I can rewrite all of that in terms of du. And so this argument here will depend on du, but I still have this v here, which is a little bit unfortunate, except that I know equality holds, and so v is equal to b minus u. So I can rewrite that as b minus u of x. And now I've rewritten the principle of net losses entirely in terms of this indirect utility u. So all this was known to Carlier, and he reformulated the monopolist's problem in the form: we want to minimize L of U and we want to minimize it over exactly those U which can be attained as maximum of some price B minus some price menu V, and those U are precisely those U which are equal to their own second transforms. And of course U is also going to be bigger than any U which arises in that form is going to be bigger than B of Y the null product minus C of the null product. So let's call this U sub null. And so my questions now are, when is the set of U that I'm minimizing over a convex set? In other words, when is the average of any two U's in the set, again in the set, again have this property? And when if the set is convex, then is the loss functional actually a convex function of U? If yes, then I can say a lot of things because of that picture. And, oh, so I have a remark. In the Roche and Chonet case, which I've now erased, the question of convexity of capital L is going to depend on C, and in the Roche and Chonet case, they took C to be strictly convex, and that helps. So I'm going to say that U is B convex if U is its own second B transform, and U is strictly B convex C is strictly B tilde convex Well, obviously C should be its own second B transform, but also if Y B C is continuous. And there's sort of a kind of duality between, just as in the ordinary Legendre transform, you have a duality between strict convexity on one side and flatness on the other. So if you have a function that has a flat spot over here, its Legendre transform is going to have a cusp at those slopes. Similarly, if this mapping here, well, and if it has a cusp, it's not C1. Similarly, if this mapping here is continuous, it's really telling you this thing here has some kind of strict convexity with respect to the valuation function B tilde. So I need a few more hypotheses other than the one that I've already written down in order to address the convexity of the set of functions I'm minimizing over. And these hypotheses are pretty similar to hypotheses which arose in the context of studying a mapping problem where you had two distributions possibly on different spaces and you're trying to correlate them so as to maximize evaluation function B. And so in that context, Ma, Schrodinger, and Wang gave sufficient conditions in order for the mapping from the first space to the second space to be smooth. they assumed that B was four times continuously differentiable on a product of two open domains in Rn. They assumed that the mappings we've already discussed were diffeomorphisms onto their ranges. And they assumed that the ranges of those two mappings were actually convex subsets of Rn or the cotangent space, depending on how you want to think of them. And then they introduced this peculiar condition that said certain fourth derivatives of B need to be controlled by certain third derivatives of B. And we will have more to say about that later. But let me write it down in a somewhat different form than they did. And actually, this hypothesis is a little stronger than what they assumed. So you want to assume that for every affine curve of the form that if I now evaluate this surplus or this valuation function at x, s, y, and t, where x and y are these curves here, that the mixed fourth derivatives be non-negative. And so I'll call this hypothesis B3. And if the inequality is strict whenever the curves don't degenerate, I'll call it B3 uniform. And I say it's a little stronger than what Ma, Schrodinger, and Wang's condition actually was, because Ma, Schrodinger, and Wang only assumed non-negativity of this mixed fourth derivative when the mixed second derivatives along the same curve vanished. So this should be evaluated at the point s equals 0 equals t. And so roughly, I mean, how to think about this condition is that really you want to say something like the mixed fourth derivatives of B are non-negative, but that turns out to be not a coordinate invariant statement in the sense that if I imagine reparametrizing the set of consumers by some diffeomorphism and reparametrizing the set of products by some other diffeomorphism, and now if my new valuation function is the old valuation function precomposed with these two diffeomorphisms, I would expect all the economic conclusions to be the same as in the original theory. And this hypothesis on the curve exactly ensures that this condition here is invariant under such kind of reparametrizations. And so this is starting to have this flavor of general relativity where the idea is that the physics should be independent of the observer that parameterizes the situation being observed. So what is this condition by you? So the first theorem is that if you assume B0 up to B2, then our strengthening of Ma, Schrödinger, and Wang's condition is actually necessary and sufficient for the ordinary convexity of the set of functions that you're varying over here. So it says my minimization problem, when I have B0 up to B3, my minimization problem is now posed on a set of, on a convex set. And the sufficiency, which is the interesting direction, was also observed independently from us for a particular evaluation function, which was minus the distance squared on the round sphere by Tominari Say, who is interested in statistics of measures supported on the sphere. So he's actually looking at things like the distribution of mass in the universe as you look out on different angles and trying to make statistical statements about that. He wanted to parameterize such distributions by functions u and then know that the set of functions u was convex in its parameterization. Of course, we also need some hypotheses on C if L is going to be a if we hope L to be a convex function of u, and it turns out that what we need is exactly the B tilde convexity of C up there. So theorem 2. Well, I didn't give a clean statement of theorem 2, but theorem 2 is assume the same conditions as theorem 1 plus hypothesis B3 plus B tilde convexity of C, then L is a convex function of U. And somehow what's key in proving the second theorem, the convexity of L is a function of U, is the following proposition. That was the proposition. Sorry, what's key to proving it is the statement down here. That the some precursor to the expression that appears in the principal's profits will actually be a convex function of the tangent vector P, assuming, well, we can even improve it to strictly convex if we have either strict B tilde convexity of C, or if we assume that this inequality here holds strictly, or if we assume that these differences down here are convex for every x naught. And maybe I should remark that what's really crucial here is the convexity of this function down here of t, because this integrand up here is built by maximizing functions like this under that hypothesis on C, right? If I have C equals I'm doing a max over x here, but this thing here is another maximum, and so it's sort of a max over x and y prime of something like b of xy minus b of xy prime plus c of y prime. Maybe there's a min somewhere in here. Okay, I'm a little worried about the minus sign and the min, but the point is that when you have convexity of these differences as a function of p, then that lifts up to convexity of that difference up there as a function of du. And if you have some kind of strict convexity, then you in these functions here, then you can lift that strict convexity of capital L, and that's enough to give you a uniqueness statement for the original economic problem that we cared about. So if one of those three strict convexity hypotheses holds, either the strict B tilde convexity of C or the strict inequality here, or the third one that was on the last slide, then the U that minimizes L of U on this set here is actually unique, mu almost everywhere, which is the set where you care about it. And in the other places, you have a lower bound on U. You can Did I get the direction of the bound correct? So you can, I'm switching back and forth between the space of agents and the space of products. The idea is you can price products that you don't want to sell arbitrarily high. Nobody will buy them, but you can't price them arbitrarily low because then someone will buy them and that will screw up your plan. So you get a one-sided inequality on U outside of the set where the agents are actually concentrated. Once you have uniqueness, you can get a stability statement, which is sort of rather technical and perhaps not so interesting, but it more or less says if you have a sequence of B's and C's and mu's that converge to a limit, if the limit's unique, then the solution to the approximating problems has to converge to the solution of the limiting problem. So what are examples of things that satisfy this? Well, of course, the original Roche-Chenet bilinear function is one example. And Ma, Schrödinger, and Wang observed that you could perturb that by adding a product of two functions, A and B. And if you then wanted to respect these hypotheses, and you took the perturbation parameter epsilon to be 1, then what you needed was the Lipschitz constant of A and B to be at most 1 for the first hypothesis, the diffeomorphism hypothesis. And if you wanted to have hypothesis B3, you needed the Hessians of A and B to have the same sign, so either both convex or both concave. And if you wanted the uniform condition here, you needed the convexity or concavity of A and B to be uniform in the sense that the Hessian should be bounded away from 0. And more or less, there's some sharpness here in this condition in the sense that if A, for example, is convex at some near some point x naught, and B fails to be convex near some y point y naught, then this perturbation here will violate B3. So that's one kind of example that is telling you something about B3. Maybe a more interesting kind of example is the example that's a little bit analogous to Say's problem. So let me first mention that I can take the Roche and Chenet example, which was the unit square, and I can reflect it in the x and y axes, and I can modify their valuation function to be minus the distance squared, still keeping the null product in the middle of the square at the origin, but I can take the cost of the principal to be 0. So this would sort of model a situation where you have a square town with residents uniformly distributed over the square, and a well in the center of the town where everyone needs to get their water. And now residents have the option of going to the well or some other place to get their water, in which case the inconvenience to them is minus 1/2 the distance squared they have to go to fetch water. Or they can pay the monopolist to deliver the water to a more convenient location for them. And the question is, what should the monopolist charge to maximize his profits? And the answer turns out to have the following form. There'll be a diamond of residents living close to the well who will go directly to the well to get their water. And in the corners of the square, those residents will pay the monopolist a high tariff in order to deliver the water quite close to them to a unique location, a location which is uniquely determined by their residential position and different from all other residents' pickup point. And in these intermediate regions here, these people will pay the monopolist to deliver the water somewhere on the diagonal or the anti-diagonal, relatively close to them, but all of these customers here will go to the same point to pick up their water. So the solution follows from exactly the same analysis as Roche and Chenet's in the upper right-hand quadrant. But what's nicer about this situation is it generalizes to other geometries. So, for example, I could take a round town instead of a square town, and what I would find is a disk in the middle of the town consisting of those people who prefer to go to the well to get their water, and then concentric rings of people who are willing to pay the monopolist to deliver their water to a location close to on some concentric ring close to them, but not quite as far from the center as where they live. And I could also, instead of taking my round town to live in flat Euclidean space, I could take it to be a spherical cap on the round sphere. And I could take the inconvenience to the customer to have to go somewhere other than where he lives to get his water to be minus the distance squared on this polar cap. And it turns out, because of Say's observation and ours, this problem is still convex, so it still has a unique solution which still respects the rotational symmetry of the spherical cap. And so again, you'll get a disk in the center of people that go to the well to fetch the water and concentric rings of people who buy water delivered by the monopolist to a ring near them. But if I set the problem on the saddle surface or on the hyperbolic disk, with the minus the hyperbolic distance squared as the penalty function, it turns out that this is now, it violates B3. And so I'm definitely minimizing over some non-convex set. I don't know that the minimum is unique anymore, and conceivably it actually violates the spherical symmetry of the problem. So you might imagine that instead of delivering to concentric rings, the monopolist is going to deliver to two lines that go along the front and the back of the saddle, and everyone will go to those two lines. I don't know. I think that's an interesting open problem. So already from these examples, you start to see that there's some kind of geometry maybe playing a role in these conditions that guarantee uniqueness of the monopolist problem. And I will say a bit more about that geometry. I first wanted to state a robustness result. Right, so about all I have to say in the direction of robustness has to do with Armstrong's observation, which was that it's a hallmark of this monopolist problem in multi-dimensions that at the optimal solution you've priced the positive fraction of agents out of the market. So that conclusion turns out to extend to all valuation functions B which satisfy our three hypotheses. If you assume also that the density of agents is continuously differentiable, say, or at least has an L1 derivative, and that the cost is B tilde convex, and then this interesting geometrical condition that says the image of the set of agents under this derivative mapping with respect to the null product, well, we assumed already that that was a convex set, but in order for the conclusion of this theorem to hold, namely that a positive fraction of agents are priced out of the market, I need to assume strict convexity of that set in the following sense. It's a convex set in n dimensions. I don't want it to have any flat spots of dimension n minus 1 in its boundary. And I think that's a pretty interesting hypothesis because in one dimension, every convex set, every bounded convex set has endpoints, and the endpoints are zero-dimensional facets. And so exactly that hypothesis is violated in one dimension, and so that's why there are these counterexamples to the conclusion of this theorem in one dimension. Alex? Nothing. Well, I mean, this is the crudest kind of bunching, but yes. Okay. So I wanted to return a little bit to the geometric interpretation of this condition here and make some kind of connections with the sort of mathematics that those of you who work in physics, and particular general relativity, would be more familiar with. So the implicit function theorem that makes this one-to-one map locally invertible is telling you that the determinant of mixed partials here has to be non-vanishing everywhere. And that implies topological information about x and y. It says that x and y have to be essentially homeomorphic to the disk. You can't have a sphere or something for either of these spaces, or things would go bad. Well, you can have the sphere, but then you need to allow for singularities in the cost function, like on the cut locus. So if I have this non-degeneracy condition, then I can introduce a symplectic form using the mixed partials of B on the product of X with Y, so this product of agent types with product types, by anti-symmetrizing here. And if I symmetrize instead, then I get a symmetric non-degenerate tensor on the product space. In coordinates, it would look like this. It would have block zeros on the diagonal, and then it would have the mixed partials off the diagonal. And that turns out to be a pseudometric tensor, and the special form of this matrix tells you the signature of the pseudometric is n comma n in this 2n-dimensional product space. So it's a little bit like Lorentzian geometry, except you have as many time-like as space-like dimensions. And if I reformulate the hypotheses B3 in terms of this pseudometric tensor, well, maybe before doing that, let me make a remark. If I think about the graph of the product selected as a function of agents in the product space, that will turn out to be Lagrangian for this symplectic form and space-like for this pseudometric tensor. And if I think about the hypotheses, it turns out that B3 has a nice reformulation in terms of this pseudometric tensor. And the reformulation is basically that I go ahead and compute the curvatures associated with this pseudometric. So the metric involved mixed second derivatives of h. The curvature is going to involve two more derivatives, so mixed fourth derivatives of h. And I'm asking that the sectional curvatures of that pseudometric tensor on the product space are non-negative in every two planes spanned by a vector parallel to the horizontal direction and a vector parallel to the vertical direction. And this convexity hypothesis on the image of these two domains also can be re-expressed in terms of geodesic convexity of the horizontal and vertical fibers with respect to the same pseudometric tensor. So because it's a pseudometric, I don't have a length for vectors, but I can still say what a geodesic is. And exactly what I'm asking in hypothesis B2 is that every n-dimensional horizontal fiber should be a light-like, totally geodesic fiber, and every n-dimensional vertical fiber should be a light-like geodesic fiber. And the hypothesis B3 was that every two planes spanned by vectors parallel to vertical and horizontal directions have non-negative sectional curvature. So I'm basically done, and I guess the conclusions that I wanted to emphasize were that somehow this desirable, economically desirable property that the theory and its conclusions be invariant under reparametrization of the agents products by diffeomorphisms implies that it ought to be described in some kind of covariant mathematical language. And so from that point of view, it's natural to see pseudo-Riemannian metric tensors and curvatures arising here for more or less the same reasons they arise in general relativity. Thank you very much. Right. So usually in PDEs, you want some information about the smoothness of the functions. And usually you want that so that you have compactness. And the story here, the story in Roche and Chenet's problem, is more or less they get compactness not by imposing some kind of smoothness, but rather by observing that the set of functions U they want to minimize over is a subset of convex functions. And for convex functions, in a certain sense, you already have some smoothness because you have a one-sided bound on the second derivative. But so there are already compactness theorems for convex functions. And I guess there is another sense in the Roche and Chenet problem because C of y was 1/2 y squared. It turns out you're going to have a term like gradient u squared in the thing you're trying to minimize, which says that you're in a sublev W12 space. If I had taken this to be 1 over p, y to the p, I would be in a sublev W1p space, and so. Yes. Yeah. So I have a PhD student who's looked at that problem a little bit, but basically all he's been able to do is generalize the result of Lachon-Robert and Carlier, that the mapping from agents to products they select will be continuous, at least on the interior. And for the Roche-Chenet problem, there's an unpublished result by Lyons and Caffarelli that says actually it will be not only continuous but Lipschitz. And maybe Lachon-Robert and Carlier goes up to the boundary and Caffarelli-Lyons is on the interior, it says Lipschitz. We haven't had any success in generalizing that to other valuation functions.
So you use the condition that m equals n all over the place.
Right.
If it wasn't k, then
yeah, so so actually I have another PhD student, Brendan Pass, who's defending his thesis next week, and he made some observations about this, which are, I think, in the thesis. So his observation is basically the following. If the dimensions of the spaces M and N are different from each other, then either you've artificially introduced some extra variables. So in other words, there's actually kind of a quotient construction that eliminates these extra dimensions to reduce you to a case where they're equal to each other, and the valuation function doesn't depend on which point in the fiber you're in before this quotient. In which case, you're back in this situation and you can ask for these kind of conditions, or else the problem is non-convex. So if it's not really an equal dimensional case in disguise, then it's non-convex. I'm sorry?
Cheap talk games?
Which kind of games?
Cheap talk.
Cheap talk.
And
Okay.
Strategic communication.
Okay.
The original problem is very similar, linear, random variable, one agent observes it, sends it to the receivers to take an action which affects both of them, which was very nice back in the 1980s. And then people were trying to work out a multi-dimensional problem, and it's very similar, and they have similar convexity assumptions. I think this could be very well applied there.
Okay, so... No, I haven't thought about it. I'm not familiar with the literature that you're referring to, so it'd be interesting to learn more about that. Maybe you can... Maybe you can give me some references afterwards. That'd be great.
I have one question. I'm wondering if you had to speculate wildly, is there any way that you could put topology into the picture?
Well, yeah. Right. So I've done a little bit of that in a slightly different context, in a related context of optimal transportation. And so basically, if B is to be a smooth function, and this mapping here is to be 1-to-1, you're out of luck as soon as the space Y has any topology. Because so, for example, if you take Y to be a compact manifold. Let me reformulate that condition in a slightly different form so you see it more easily. So never mind the smooth inverse part. Just asking is that mapping 1-to-1 is equivalent to asking it's equivalent to saying that for every y1 distinct from y2. I hope I didn't get x and y confused. Yeah, I think I'm okay. Whoops. Something is okay. But this mapping here has no critical points. Right? So a critical point of this function on X is precisely a Y1 and Y2, which have the same image under this map. And of course, that can't happen if X is compact and B is differentiable. And so when you look at optimal mapping problems where instead of having a variable target distribution, both distributions are fixed and you're trying to correlate them so as to maximize B, you need this hypothesis. This hypothesis guarantees uniqueness of the maximizing correlation, and it also guarantees that the product Y selected as a function of the agent who chooses them is unique. And of course, you can't have this when you have topology here. But if you modify this hypothesis to say it has no critical points except for a single global min and a single global max, which effectively forces the topology of X to be the sphere by Morse theory, it turns out that the solution to the maximizing correlation problem is still unique. But it's no longer true. Although it's unique, it's no longer true that almost every agent uniquely selects a single product, but rather there in some situations there will be a positive fraction of agent types who select different at which each of those types selects two or more different products in prescribed ratios. So it's like a mixed strategy. It's a unique solution with a mixed strategy. Nobody knows the condition which guarantees uniqueness of that maximum correlation function under a more general kind of more structure for this thing here. So for example, take your space of agents and products to be distributed on the torus, and take a smooth D function like cosine of the difference of the horizontal angles plus cosine of the difference between the vertical angles. Nobody knows whether it's generically true that you get a unique maximizing correlation for that. I think there's some nice topological questions there.